Hi there. This is your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness. If you've listened to this show, you know we end each week with a post-show disclaimer, belated spoiler alert. This is a tongue-in-cheek allusion to something that used to happen with regular frequency on the show. Dean spoiling something and then announcing spoiler alert once the cat was out of the proverbial bag. Nowadays, Dean and I tend to be far more artful in our spoilers, speaking about matters artistic with the subtlety of quantum physicists. In our conversations, when they do contain spoilers, the cat is both in and out of the bag, depending on whether you are interested in the deeper ramifications of the themes being discussed. 50 years ago, the television show The Prisoner premiered. Leading up to the finale of its 17-episode run, viewers were hoping for a James Bondian resolution to the show's mysteries. Patrick McGoohan himself, the creator and star of the show, was hoping to nail an ending that would make people angry, their fists waving in his face. The show would go on to be called the most intelligent, thought-provoking entertainment series ever created. And after the answers to all questions were revealed in the final 2 hours, actually, the assuredly angry audience was then left to look at the answers and ask, but what does it mean? The show ended the only place it could, back at the beginning, and the point of the allegory was quite literally driven home. I can only imagine how Patrick McGoohan would respond to the knee-jerk fear on the part of so many viewers these days of having spoilers affect their enjoyment of a work. After all, The Prisoner is a show that answered viewers' most pressing question, who is number one, during the opening credits of each and every episode. The fact that the audience did not notice, until after the fact, spoke to why McGoohan hoped to make people angry. Quite frankly, he wanted viewers to wake the hell up, and one of the things he was trying to awaken them to was the awesome potentiality the medium itself had as an art form. It's taken 50 years for The Prisoner to have company in the pantheon of great, thought-provoking entertainment series. With its two-episode finale last week, it's safe to say Twin Peaks: The Return belongs in that company. Much like The Prisoner, hour one of the two-part finale gave actual resolution and answers, and hour two inspired new and hopefully better questions. Both shows end where they began, both arguing forcefully that you can never go home again. Honestly, I think it's impossible to analyze the recent revival of Twin Peaks and spoil anything. Good storytelling transcends any potential spoilers and often requires context and previous understanding. No matter how many plot twists a piece of work may offer, the plot twists had better be the least of what the work offers, or it's honestly not that good. There's a reason why, even when the quote-unquote twists are already known to you, that a work like The Prisoner or movies like Psycho get better and better with each viewing. It's because the resolution of plot merely is a gateway to the exploration of larger mysteries and more compelling themes. How impossible is it to spoil Twin Peaks: The Return? Well, for instance, the character of Annie Blackburn, the half-sister of Norma Jennings, fresh out of a convent and played by a young Heather Graham in season 2 of the show's original run, is one of the key figures in The Return, and she doesn't even appear in the new season, nor is she even referenced. You see, she probably was not real to begin with. A tulpa, perhaps, a thought form created by lodge dwellers. That name, Blackburn, like the smell of oil, sure was telling, as was her otherworldly sense of pain and oddity of speech, much of which we witness in other characters this season. She first appears in the town of Twin Peaks weeks after Laura's murder, though she appeared to Laura herself in the days leading up to her death in a dream, where she tells Laura she is trapped in the lodge with Dale Cooper. By the time these 25 years had passed between the end of the show's first run and the production of the second series, the character had been retconned out of existence. There is no mention of her in the timeline at all, nor in the book. One of myriad contradictions in temporal consistency. There were contradictions between Fire Walk With Me and the first two seasons, of course. But there was also inherent contradictions within Fire Walk With Me. There were contradictions between the book and The Return, and the old series and Fire Walk With Me, but each contained contradiction within themselves. If I had not read the book, The Secret History of Twin Peaks, I would have been ill-prepared to deal with the timeline retconning that was taking place almost from the outset of the new series. It's one of the reasons why I urge those who watched to familiarize themselves with Fire Walk With Me and the book, for these were the two works where Lynch and Frost's storytelling was in no way interfered with by executive notes. Moreover, if I had not recently rewatched what I increasingly have come to regard as a true Lynch masterpiece, Lost Highway, and realized for the first time that that film is, in no small part, a time travel story, I would have been denied context that served me greatly in my appreciation for the new series. One of my favorite lines in all of Twin Peaks: The Return is an hilarious underlining of the time manipulation at play. David Lynch's very own Gordon Cole says at one point, "Apologies in advance for Albert," after Albert has said the offending remark. At several key points, Cole would fill in his colleagues and the audience on information about events that had not happened yet. Or had they? In another timeline. Time in the town of Twin Peaks does not run at the same speed as in other cities, such as Las Vegas. It also does not run in one linear direction, as later events clearly take place prior to earlier episodes. Cars are shown driving on the wrong side of the road during all of Nadine's long walk to set Ed, her long-suffering husband, long dreaming of his true love Norma, free from his long-standing nightmare. David Lynch loves the dream logic born of his exploration into transcendental meditation and the unified field theory. It's a love I share. It's tempting, or terrifying, or both, to interpret The Return as dream. After all, we are literally told to ask time and time again, who is the dreamer? And beautiful essays have been written about whether it might, in fact, be a dream of Laura Palmer's. All of Twin Peaks, a death dream, a la Diane Selwyn in Lynch's masterful Mulholland Drive. So is the dreamer Laura? Is it Cooper, who seems to realize his dual role as both dreamer and as one living inside the dream, a realization visually expressed to us in quite certain terms in that penultimate hour? Or is it Audrey, who seems to have an awakening? Or is it series creator David Lynch? After all, when Monica Bellucci, as Monica Bellucci, asks, who is the dreamer, she then points over Gordon Cole's shoulder to where we see a young David Lynch, the man who literally dreamt up this entire universe. It's quite possible that we are all the dreamer, and our dreams come from the same unified field, where their meaning and interpretation is subjective to each of our unique experiences. And as such, even if it is a dream, it in no way diminishes our basic task of asking, what does it mean? Perception of time and how that perception shapes our beliefs of who and what we are is at the center of meaning in Twin Peaks. Questions of identity have always been forefront on the mind of David Lynch and strike at the heart of his characters' inquiries. You will find some who believed, or feared, that the entire series The Return was about a Dale Cooper suffering from multiple personality disorder. Throughout the show, there were visual clues that he had six distinct personalities. And sure enough, we meet six, however briefly. The Cooper, who has been waiting in the lodge for 25 years. The one who finally returns to us in a Las Vegas hospital room following a self-electrocution-induced coma. The evil Cooper doppelganger, Mr. C, to whom we are first introduced at the end of season two, when he asks, "How's Annie?" There is the Douglas Jones Tulpa of Mr. C, who is quickly replaced by Dougie Jones, the sleepwalking incarnation of Agent Cooper. There is the Dreamer, who steps forward in the penultimate episode and realizes that the Cooper we have identified as the real one must remove himself from the timeline we believe we have been following for almost three decades. Finally, there is Richard, the Cooper who seems a blending of all of these, who appears after he and Diane have crossed over into the timeline created by Cooper's removal of Laura Palmer from Twin Peaks prior to her murder. So, like Patrick McGoohan before him, Kyle MacLachlan has become number six. And it's an appropriate number, as it's the number of intuition, the greatest investigative tool in the arsenal of any agent, but especially Agent Cooper. And the only number that, when turned upside down, becomes another number. We see Cooper become another number again and again until finally they have all seemed to come together as Richard. And like his forebear, number six, Cooper himself is and always will be a prisoner in the quest for justice against the forces of fire and darkness, a battle that cannot be won, but one that must always be waged. If this missive of mine serves any function, it's that I hope you will do yourselves a favor and visit or revisit the allegorical worlds created by David Lynch and Patrick McGoohan before him, and do so knowing that we've been given all the answers we need. A year from now, perhaps, a consensus will have formed around the questions being asked, one of the most pressing of which seems to be, "But what happened to Audrey?" And of course, I would argue that nothing happened to Audrey. We see Laura's body disappear, her murder never having happened. Much of life in Twin Peaks will go on unchanged. People will still have secrets. Their soap opera lives will unspool as before. There will be changes, however, as exemplified by Coop and Laura's nighttime return to present-day Twin Peaks. We know it is a contemporary trip because of the prices on the modern Valero gas sign outside the town. By the time they make it into town, however, the sign of change is literal. No longer double R to go, the diner's sign has reverted to the plain old double R. One imagines the website of Double R to Go is no more as well, that modern life and its supposed conveniences have not quite caught up to Twin Peaks, which has remained a town that time has somewhat forgotten. After all, if Laura never died, Cooper and the FBI never arrived. If Cooper never arrived, his doppelganger never took over. If his doppelganger never took over, Mr. C never rapes Audrey, who never gives birth to Richard. That trauma is avoided, and nothing happened to Audrey. At least, nothing we have seen. What does not change is who, fundamentally, Dale Cooper and Laura Palmer are. Laura, created by the Fireman to draw the fire of the dark forces, will continue to do that, universe after universe, timeline after timeline. Cooper, our white knight, will be the magician retconning timelines, as he's been doing for 25 years, seeking Laura out, not saving her, finding her, so that he might battle the forces of evil she attracts. Through the darkness of futures past, the magician longs to see. One chance out between two worlds, fire, walk with me. Moreover, although she was never mentioned by name, Audrey was alluded to specifically during a conversation in the final episode of Twin Peaks: The Return. Certainly, by the time the next show to demand comparison with The Prisoner and Twin Peaks rolls around, in, about 50 years from now, we should have a good handle on the deeper ramifications of this final episode.
What year is this?
For now, I simply remind you of that rather banal conversation that takes place at the Odessa, Texas home of Laura, a.k.a. Carrie Page. Cooper slash Richard convinces Laura slash Carrie to come with him. But before they can hit the road to a house whose locale she no longer knows, they talk about whether she needs a coat, just as Audrey in an earlier episode did with her husband, Charlie, before leaving for a roadhouse whose locale she no longer knows. We got the answers we needed. We might just need to start asking better questions. This is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
And now, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
I don't believe in superstars, organic food and foreign cars. I don't believe the price of gold, the certainty of growing old, that right is right and left is wrong, that north and south can't get along, that east is east and west is west, and being first is always best. But I believe in love. I believe in babies. I believe in mom and dad, and I believe in you.
So, Dean Haglund, what's the weather like where you are?
It's slowly warming up. It's springtime. There's still a cool Antarctic breeze in the air, but the sun shines earlier every morning as the...
You might want to sound a little more glum, affect a little more of a guilty Canadian attitude towards that. It is, let's remember, the anniversary of 9/11. It is September 11th, as people are able to listen to this as we are recording it where you are. And we're celebrating the anniversary of the attacks of 9/11 here by having Hurricane Irma hit land on the continental United States. So it is a scary time. And, of course, this is just in the wake of what got very little news in this country, an 8.1 earthquake in Mexico.
I read about that here.
Killed
Nobody's talking about
many
that there.
People. Well, you know, we're on storm watch. And finally, you know... especially Florida politicians, keep mentioning in interviews leading up to the storm and during the storm the need to talk about climate change. So that is refreshing, at least. And I know that in the wake of every gun shooting in America, every gun death in America, there are quarters that say, well, this is the wrong time to be talking about gun policy. Just as after, you know, these catastrophic storms, there are people who say, well, this is the wrong time to be talking about climate change policy. I beg to disagree. Now would be the perfect time to talk about it, when we're able to say all the predictive models have come true. So let's do what we can. And I mention this apropos of earthquakes because, boy, around the globe, in places that had never been thought to have seismic activity before, both in the continental United States and on other continents as well, we have seen not only earthquake activity, but then in areas with fault line activity, we are seeing unprecedented sizes of earthquakes, magnitudes of earthquakes. And then you go and you read that this is part of the predictive model of climate change as well, because with
extra earthquakes,
because of the reduction in the Earth's ice and ice flow and the ice caps,
right?
It literally,
tectonic plates, the weight goes off it.
The weight goes off of it. So,
and the springs back to life.
And we try to restore some of the weight that this great planet deserves through your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour and through that opus
bringing you down.
That I launched today's episode with into the majesty of both Twin Peaks and The Prisoner, which, of course, is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Now, Dean Haglund, I think we are celebrating the one-week anniversary of the Sydney Hilarium.
We are! Oh, my gosh. And what a week it's been. Jam-packed with people and hilarity, show after show.
I don't like however.
Well,
what?
Well, no, it's still tricky to find for a lot of people. It's on level 4 at 10 Kensington in Chippendale, above 3 other restaurants, and you have to find the lift, the elevator in the back of
you say is you go into Chippendale's and you ask for a lift in back, and that won't get you into any trouble at all.
No, you heard that wrong. You go into the old rum building.
I do remember that from last week. That's my favorite part of last week's show. Of course, if people are tuning into the 22nd minute of this week's Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, hoping that we are going to map quest their way to the Sydney Hilarium, they've got bigger problems than finding the club.
That's true.
I am curious about whether or not there are any audio recordings that we may be able to excerpt for future installments of this very soundcast.
You know, that would have been really smart of me to do that very thing, which I didn't do. That would have been smart.
But there's still several weeks left of the Hilarium.
There absolutely is. So let's say that's going to happen.
That would be fun. I would love it if you would send me some audio and explanations of what they are, and we could include them in future installments. That would be fun.
That would be very fun.
Now, because it's always so much more sad when a show business personage dies than when just a civilian shuffles off the mortal coil, here's this week's celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
We'll go quickly through these. Blake Heron, the former child actor best known for starring in the 1997 film Shiloh, died.
Oh, yeah.
He was found unresponsive in his home in Los Angeles, although I'm making a joke about somebody's death. I find most actors unresponsive in their homes. Anyway, according to Variety, a friend said he had been sick with the flu for several days, and the cause of his death has not yet been determined. However, he had been open about his battle with drug addiction. He recently played an addict in the dark comedy film 1,000 Junkies, which was recently screened at the 2017 Tribeca Film Festival.
Oh.
Jack Keel, the advertising executive who led the team that created what, Dean Haglund? John Jack Keel... He created what? He also voiced this creation. The advertising
Tony the Tiger.
No, but you're along the right track. It is a name followed by the word the, followed by a descriptive and an animal.
Ribbit the Frog. okay, I give up.
Okay. He created and voiced McGruff the Crime Dog.
McGruff the Crime Dog, damn it. I sort of knew that.
So John Jack Keel died at 94. He was the creative director at Dancer Fitzgerald Sample Advertising Agency when he and his team created the trench coat-wearing animated dog, and it was Keel himself saying the slogan, "Take a bite out of crime."
And what was that dog supposed to do? He was supposed to just make me not go into crime?
Yeah, I mean, because he's gonna get you. The junkyard dog of criminal detection is gonna get you. Walter Becker, the co-founder and guitarist of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band Steely Dan, has died at the age of 67. Becker met his longtime musical collaborator Donald Fagen when both were attending Bard College. They formed a band in college that included whom as their drummer?
Oh, I'm supposed to know this, my music aficionado. Kicking into high gear.
Well, you were a drummer. You were a drummer, and though you weren't a prog rock drummer, you were of this era a little bit. And and you know, Becker and Fagen, they had real legitimacy for a lot of musicians such as yourself back then. So who was their drummer? No pressure, but Lily Holloman answered this correctly before I even finished the question.
What? Oh my gosh. Joey Ramone.
Chevy Chase.
Come on.
Chevy Chase was their drummer. Anyway, Becker and Fagen then became songwriters in New York City, and of course they became known for their cerebral, wry lyrics and sharp cultural observations of Steely Dan. I'm not going to lie, there was a time when this was one of my five favorite bands, Steely Dan, and indeed, when they finally rejoined, I guess in the early 90s, that concert was a big one for me. Went down and saw it, Irvine Meadows. Does that still exist, that amphitheater?
Wow.
Anyway, that's where I went to see them. Isn't it crazy to think that it's been so much longer since their reunion than it was between their breakup and their reunion? But anyway, that stuff was very, very cool and influential. And finally, a man that we heard during our special opening today, Don Williams, award-winning country singer with love ballads like the one I excerpted, I Believe in You, has died at 78 years of age. He had 17 number one country hits before retiring in 2016. His sound influenced an entire generation of singers, including Joe Nichols and Josh Turner. And Keith Urban has said that Don Williams drew him into country music. He was nicknamed the Gentle Giant. He had a rich voice, gentle delivery, and storytelling style. He toured sparingly, did very few media interviews, and spent most of his time on his farm west of Nashville. And that is your Celebrity Deaths of the Week. I like that I turned it into a little bit of a game show.
I know. I thought there was a new musical sting that you had already prepared.
Dean, I guess I have to have prizes for you. I've got to have prizes, and if you get these right or something, I don't know, it's weird.
Yeah, something goes on.
Yeah, something. We'll figure it out. But people love the production meetings on the air. Okay, in the wake of last week's conversation about the Civil War, Robert E. Lee, war memorials, and more, we got the following thoughts on monuments. Phil and Dean. I was expecting that. God, now you leave me hanging. I'm so used to this.
I'm on the edge of my seat about this one of thoughts of fun.
All right, Phil and Dean, growing up in Va, which I think is Virginia, but a musket shot away from the many battlefields where so many people fought and died, I can say that it was a very prevalent topic of discussion in schools. I don't know that this makes me the best person for the topic, but I thought I would weigh in on, if not monuments, what? My thought is museums. D.C. is full of them, and they tell some of the most horrific stories of human rights atrocities you can imagine. I don't have to walk or drive to work and look at a statue of Hitler, but I know that if I want to learn about the worst of our past, I can go to a museum and see pictures and artifacts from that time. It's my choice.
Right.
If remembering our past so that we don't repeat it is as important as we all know it is, we should be okay having places where that information and those pieces of history are housed. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. One who doesn't learn from history is doomed to repeat it. So at the same time, putting monuments out in public places, that, how does that one go again?
Well, absent the nuance in the story, I think. Like, you know, the national park that I referenced last week, Vicksburg, with all its monuments and memorials to both the North mm-hmm. and the South, not every monument or memorial is explained, though many of them are, with the stories of them. And that's incredibly helpful. But also the entire purpose behind this park and its layout is explained from the outset. So you really understand why it's important and what the messages are they hope you will take away from it. And I think that's important.
Right.
Context, spoilers, if you will, are important.
You're right.
Give the context of why we are memorializing this and for what purpose. I don't think it's the idea of statues per se, but the idea of immortalizing people in statue without the story being available immediately to those who come to it, and hopefully a story that is full of the good and the bad and the so-called ugly, or that explains why maybe not this person, but this person for this particular act or event, then we could come to some sort of mutually agreed upon acceptance of these kind of memorials and monuments. And where you get that context is in museums. I don't think it's impossible to put it out in public.
Right.
It's why, like I mentioned, you know, Robert E. Lee memorials, him on a horse in his Civil War uniform in these parks. Well, he himself argued that that should never happen. He himself argued that that was hurtful and that was divisive of a nation that needed to heal its wounds. But him memorialized at Lee, Washington and Lee University, a university that bears his name because he was president of it, at Lee Chapel, where he is buried. Well, I have no problem with that, although, again, there is now some writing going on about some of his misdeeds as president of the university, but that's a different issue. But the idea that he would be memorialized there at a university where he gave the many years of his life for the service of higher education, yes, he probably ought to be memorialized for that particular service. And, of course, there at the school, it can be explained.
Right. If you don't have an explanation, though...
Exactly.
Exactly. Okay.
Future generations, what are they going to do? They're going to go, wow, this must have been a great man. Right? Automatically, they're going to leap to that conclusion. The story needs to be told. Now, we have been to Germany, have we not? We've been to Berlin, where I famously joked that they are rife with monuments, right? They have the monument to the people who were shot, and they have the monument to the people who were gassed, and they have the monument to the people who died of fear that they might be shot or gassed.
Right.
And so, again, it's not the issue of monuments. It's not the issue of memorials. It's that the context and the story needs to be told. And if we can't do that, well, then it's best left for a museum or for a space that can.
Right. And even the Stasi prison wasn't torn down, but opened up as a, Cold War era the torture place that reminded even the tour guides who were tortured there.
Right.
To tell future generations.
Yeah.
Of, you know, think of that, how important that was and how gripping that was for, you know, us fun-loving tourists here.
Right. Right. And then you could have a place where maybe some of the debates we need to have could take place in public settings, especially if the stories were nuanced and textured that went around them.
Right.
And then, barring those, yeah, let's get rid of statues. I don't know if we need statues of famous people, right? I don't know if we I don't know if we do. If it's not an educational experience and exercise, we should not be kneeling and worshiping icons.
There you go, crush all icons.
That letter, that email comes to us from none other than John Lawler. His voice and his instrumental music playing, the making of the noise that opens each and every show, usually not heard this week, but at least he's been a part of the episode.
Hooray!
Now, something we have not done for a while called Lawsuit of the Week.
Oh, hooray!
The Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
This comes from someone who's often associated with another part of the show, what we're reading. It comes from Stephen Fowler of the Smokin' All-Stars. Wrote on Facebook saying that this might make an interesting lawsuit of the week. Then again, it might require more research that you don't have time to do. But how can you ignore something if you don't know about it? See, that's right. One of those better questions I was advocating in the opening when I talked about The Prisoner and Twin Peaks. Okay, this is a potential lawsuit that deals with the NBC series Amazing Stories that took its title from the Amazing Stories magazine. And there is a website called AmazingStoriesMag.com and then /NBC-Amazing-Stories. I'll put the link in the description to the show. But the author of this, who was the publisher and creator of Amazing Stories magazine, wrote in part, NBC executed a contract with me to option the use of the name Amazing Stories for a redo of the 80s Spielberg show. They failed to pay the initial option fee. They unilaterally exercised the right to extend it for an additional year, still having not paid me, and have not paid me that fee either. They were notified of a breach of contract and termination of the same in May of this year. 1 week prior to the end of the term of the original contract, they contacted my attorney and demanded that I sign the agreement to exercise the option and license the name and have threatened to sue me if I do not.
Oh my gosh.
I am of the current opinion that they are going to move forward with making the show and force me to sue them for infringement if I can pony up the bucks to launch that lawsuit. Following the notice of termination, I found another studio that is eager and excited to work on Amazing Stories TV show. To whatever extent you can, I'm requesting your assistance in trying to make NBC let go. All I want them to do is acknowledge the receipt of the notice of breach and termination so that I can move forward with this project. And it's a very lengthy post that goes on to talk about the legal history of it. But one of the most fascinating parts is he writes what you can do. A, share this post far and wide. Permission to reprint in full is granted. B, offer up your own stories of Hollywood malfeasance if you have them and if they can be related. C, realize that this really is an underdog story. The studio, part of one of the largest media conglomerates in the world, is trying to put one over on a little guy. Their first move will be to ignore me or to try to run me out of money. D, write to NBC headquarters legal department and demand that they honor the notice of breach and termination publicly. And he lists the address and the phone number. And then, I love this, E, if you could contact Steven Spielberg, Brian Fuller, Patton Oswalt, Kumail Nanjiani, Emily Gordon, Jane Goldman, or any of the other people who are writing scripts for the infringing version of this show, let them know they are working on a project that NBC does not have the rights to. And finally, let the world know that if NBC produces a show titled Amazing Stories, it was done by infringing and at the expense of the very magazine that helped found this genre, and that this not only doesn't help advance the genre, it plays into the hands of those who have little to no respect for it, obviously don't understand its nuances, and are helping to undermine and dumb it down. I'm not weighing in on any side, but hooray for this guy doing this.
I'll say.
You know, I'm intrigued in learning more and following this as it develops.
Absolutely. I assume he has the original option agreement in front of him that would be clear cut. I am reminded of the lawsuit with CBS and the... who was the 60s? He created Mannix and all of those TV shows that had three acts. Remember? Now I'm going to be pissed
Quinn
off.
Martin.
But basically,
Quinn Martin.
Quinn Martin Productions. And Quinn Martin got 10 television pilots based on a lawsuit with CBS that didn't allow them to pull out of the agreement. So they didn't have a clause in there that made them renege. And instead of suing for cash, he sued for 10 more pilots. And that's how Quinn Martin Productions came to be. So I'm looking forward to researching this more as well and finding out all about it. Perhaps Amazing Stories suddenly has 10 pilots ahead of them.
Well, yes, we'll follow up on that. Now, finally, I'm almost amazed that we do, but we have like 20 minutes to talk about movies.
What?
Next week, we're going to talk about a lot of movies. When we finally get in depth, or well, maybe it's not next week. We don't know. I guess I shouldn't promise that. But we are doing a special show where we look at that British Film Institute list about the movies that everybody should see before they're 14 years of age. Just in time for us to turn 14. And, you know, last week was a wonderful week for me. I got to present, a treatise on, Will Rogers, the great Will Rogers at Friendship Auditorium as part of a Sunday evening ice cream social presentation of, his movie, Life Begins at 40. And in trying to pick the right, film, of his, I watched so many Will Rogers movies, as well as the 1952 biopic about him, where his son, Will Rogers Jr., a former congressman at that time and a war hero, played his dad. And it was directed by Michael Curtiz of Casablanca fame and starred Jane Wyman, such a great actress. And it was the story of Will Rogers. So I really immersed myself in his work. And boy, he was really a gifted actor. Of course, a renowned wit and comedian, but these movies are really something and quite timely. Sometimes a little uncomfortable because of the race relations, but really thematically quite apropos of the era in which we live. And it made me realize, as I've been watching more and more kind of early 1930s comedies, Dean, especially pre-code comedies.
Pre-code, yes.
How many of them actually speak to contemporary issues?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I find...
Do tell.
Well, I just find... Well, now, this is not a pure comedy. It's musical, right? But Top Hat. I finally saw 1935's Top Hat, directed by Mark Sanders.
Fred Astaire.
This is, Astaire and Ginger Rogers. But one of the key supporting roles is Edward Everett Horton. And, oh my goodness, who was, famously, I wasn't prepared for this. The Mad Hatter in the live action Alice in Wonderland.
Oh yes,
and of course Alice did so many fantastic comedic roles. He himself was not openly gay, but rather famously gay in Hollywood, and there is an actual overtly gay manservant character in Top Hat. It's so forward-thinking at its time in a way that I don't think in just a couple of years movies would be allowed to be.
That's so true. And in fact, there was that documentary Closet Hollywood or something, I think it was called, that used excerpts to show how comedies were subversively putting gay characters and gay references in for big laughs in the 1930s. And Top Hat's a prime example of that.
I certainly think that the 1930s are a great era for comedy. Coming in the wake of silent film and losing the ability to move the camera, right? Needing to now kind of find their footing again in terms of how to visually tell these stories when they are so...
But using verbal... Yeah, verbal gags and verbal wit.
Though a lot of visual wit obviously did go into things like, production design and costuming and these. It's not that there wasn't visual wit, but the camera couldn't move. It was there was great mise-en-scène, great composition, but they had to learn really, if they didn't start at square one again, they were set back several paces. But comedy really emerges, I think, as a far more advanced form in the 1930s rather than any other genre. Largely because of this, right? And because there were so many brilliant performers that had, through not only silent film, but especially vaudeville and radio, been able,
absolutely,
like Will Rogers, to perfect a certain persona that translated well to the screen.
Totally. And it came at a time when the end of the Max Sennett Studio silent film, they had their own way of constructing gags, directing jokes, being able to improvise while the camera was running, something that you couldn't do with sound film. And so they had to find a whole new generation of comedians to fill in talkies, as it were, sound comedies, and where else to go but a rich 50-year tradition of stage that had toured the country. So you had all these highly honed verbal comedians that were just waiting to be sucked into the movies. And that gave you the Marx Brothers. Think of Abbott and Costello. So many acts, so many that not just came from vaudeville, but also the burlesque circuit and all that sort of thing. It was a fantastic time of technology and performance.
And it's something that's really missing in terms of contemporary time, you know?
It really is. I mean, we have stand-up comedy clubs, but that in itself is an art form that not always translates well into acting, a la, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, for instance.
Though God,
he's not a great actor.
God bless him. It's coming out on Blu-ray, DVD, I think this week. But we mentioned Kumail Nanjiani. You know, he wrote with his wife the indie film The Big Sick that was quite a hit this summer. And he really does seem to have found a comedic persona for himself to play that allows itself to be adapted for a variety of different kinds of stories and for both lead and supporting performances. He is kind of a throwback to me in that way. But, you know, when there are comedies made, they seem to all be such high concept comedies instead of, you know, these character based comedies that surround circumstances that you could put the little tramp in, or you could put Keaton's old stone face in, or you could put the Marx Brothers in, or you could put Bill Murray's kind of shoulders down, you know, slack jawed, impress me universe, world weary attitude towards, you know, these kind of enduring comic personas that lent themselves towards exploration of a lot of different themes and topics. And we're missing that. But I do hope that The Big Sick is just the first of many for Kumail, because I think he really lends himself to being that kind of figure.
Absolutely. And it comes also from his personality. You know, he came over to, he's a big X-Files fan and has a very successful podcast called The X-Files X-File, where he goes through in detail every episode of The X-Files, and came over and interviewed me on, I think, the very first Gumman appearance. And because of his natural personality, along with his stand-up chops and his acting chops, it sort of is a perfect trifecta, as it were, for him.
Yeah. I'm also, interestingly enough, you know, at a time when it's tough to find, you know, really great comedy work being done now and to be studying comedies of the 30s, I also am finding it just, I mean, this was not a plan on my part, but I just happened to watch a couple of 1960s science fiction films that I hadn't seen before. And I realize how much there is for that genre to learn now from them. One was a movie called 5 Million Years to Earth, which was the third of the big screen Quatermass movies. And it was from 1967. And it's got great ideas. The ideas hold up really well, and some of the performances are super cool. And then the other one was the original The Time Machine, directed by George Pal in 1960, with Rod Taylor and so many wonderful character actors. You know, as the time travel expedition itself goes on, the film probably gets weaker and weaker and becomes just an expression of its ideas. But boy, that is something still that is so often missing from science fiction films today, especially films that are remaking sci-fi from that era, where they're all about everything but the ideas. The ideas don't live on and resonate. And when they do, in a case like a movie like Interstellar for Christopher Nolan, they actually lack the fun that those 1960s sci-fi movies had.
Yeah, and that's always something too, right? Is the fun of exploring an idea as opposed to giving it so much weight and so much science, as it were. That science in itself is such a curmudgeon that it would we need more science in our science fiction. So we're gonna just drag this colossal thing down explaining every pseudo technological advance.
Well, you just hit the word. I don't think it's about the science. I think it's about the technology. I think it gets bogged down in technology, both the technology on screen, but also the technology of making the movies has a tendency to suck some of the fun out of it because less and less imagination is being brought to bear in terms of making it and in terms of watching it.
I agree.
But something you said also, I was struck by, did you ever hear James Doohan, who loved in real life engineering manuals, but how he hated the lingo of what Star Trek became in later iterations, because he spent all his life hanging out with engineers and he said none of them talk in technical jargon.
Right?
Because they all know it. They all each other know it. So they use shorthand with each other, which was how his Scotty did it in the original series, which is what both made it believable but also really fun.
Yes. I'm thinking, of course, too, of a similar book, or a book-to-movie adaptation, The Martian, that Ridley Scott directed. That was Andrew Weir's book.
Right.
I don't know if you ever picked up that book. I just saw it in a bookstore, and I just read a couple pages, and it kind of jumps off the page. It's really fun, and it seems to be shorthand. You know, it's explaining all the science of how you're going to survive by yourself for months on end with only potatoes in a small air shack and how you start communicating with Houston again. But it was written in such a fast, light pace from an engineering point of view that it had the similar feel of a one scientist talking to another. He wasn't assuming that I didn't know these things in the book, whereas in the movie, it really bogged down, I thought.
Did you really? I thought certainly what it has going for it at its best is a breezy tone. That's when it's at its best, the tone is breezy. Matt Damon does a lot of good work to bring it that breezy tone. I think that's why, all jokes aside, that's why he was nominated for the Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Comedy. Because he actually was worthy of a comedic telling of that, but a lot of people did scratch their heads because you're probably right. In the hands of Ridley Scott, at times that tone really did bog down. But I do like going back to these '60s films and realizing, or even TV, Star Trek in the '60s, Planet of the Apes, Twilight Zone. You know, in the hand of really good writers, you have this combination of the exploration of the ideas being fun. As you said, and a lot of times that's missing, one or the other. Either the ideas or the fun seem to be missing. You took a couple of long trips to and from Vancouver a couple weeks back when you shot The X-Files, and I'm wondering if you caught any films on those flights that you want to rip open to see what makes them tick.
Well, since we're on comedies, I did catch Goldie Hawn and Amy Schumer in Snatched. Now, you laugh aside. This is done almost by the numbers in terms of mistaken identity, lost in Central America, fish out of water, daughter-mother bonding moments, all of these things, right? How there is both the awareness of, oh, these things have to be light, they have to feel improvisational, and at the same time, that awareness giving it the mud that they have trouble getting out of. It was weird that the self-awareness of the genre itself caused it both to try to give it an improvisational tone and at the same time collapse under its own weight of self-awareness. Could that possibly make sense?
I'm just delighted that you are working hard to compile your worst films of the year list. I was thinking about Goldie Hawn and that movie. No. I was thinking about that movie though and her because I saw Death Trap again this week. Which is not a great movie, but I visited a friend and we watched it, and I was thinking about it because I've always been a bit of a fan of Diane Cannon, and I realized that she kind of vanishes to a real degree after Death Trap in 1982. She got a Golden Razzie nomination for Worst Actress for it, which was so unfair because she's the best thing in it. She's the only thing breathing life into this, trapped in its head. Death Trap, yeah. And when she's gone in the film has no life to it at all. So I always felt that was really unfair. But what's interesting is kind of the reason she disappears is she's in her mid-40s at that point, and after Death Trap, all the roles that would have been right for her go to Goldie Hawn. It's like, the amount of roles, there aren't enough for both of them. And Goldie Hawn's the bigger box office draw, so she gets the kind of career that Diane Cannon could have had later in life. I don't know if that's interesting or what, but it occurred to me. And Diane Cannon was really, really quite a delightful performer up until that point. So what else did you see? What else did you catch?
Oh, my God. Well, see, this is the problem. Air Canada seems to have a limited amount of movie selection, unlike United or Qantas, believe it or not. And they work hard to do some international movies, which, let's see, where's my list? The other sad thing is I actually slept 13 hours on one of the flights. That is unheard of.
That's fantastic.
That is fantastic. So basically, ate, fell asleep, and then they nudged me awake for eating again. That's how fast that flight went. What was the one I saw? Gee whiz. Okay, while I'm remembering what I saw, why don't you tell us what you saw?
Okay, I've got three recent ones to talk about. The first of which is Their Finest, and this is the year's other Dunkirk movie, told from the point of view of a film crew that is making a propaganda film in England about the rescue of the troops at Dunkirk. And specifically the story of a couple of women who took their drunken, abusive father's boat out to go rescue some of the boys. And it is a movie with charm. It got pretty good reviews. I was a little bit surprised that with the delightful Gemma Arterton starring and with able support from none less than the fantastic Bill Nighy, that this film didn't really make its mark either here or in England. And it's interesting because as I'm watching this movie, I was seeing, here's a problem. Bill Nighy is the kind of actor that no matter how weird he is, he invites you in. And Gemma Arterton...
Right.
Maybe is miscast because she is so jaw-droppingly beautiful and trying to play someone who is really damped down, a working-class girl, and yet you see the actresses in the movie within the movie, and then you see her, and you go, well, wait, she's the movie star. And so it doesn't really work, right? But at the same time, there's nothing about her. You spend the whole movie feeling at arm's length from her. And I say to myself, see, this is the problem. This is why we need more women directing, why we need more women writing. Yeah. And then I look at the credits and a woman directed it and a woman wrote it. So go figure why, both for me and women I know who have seen it, they feel entirely detached from the lead character. Nevertheless, like I said, a film with some charm, and I completely advocate that you take the Christopher Nolan big screen epic Dunkirk and take the independent, charming, wistful comedy Their Finest, and you just go scene by scene watching them back and forth. Have them up side by side on two screens, and then you might come away with one satisfying viewing experience.
Oh.
I also saw another film directed by a woman that I don't think got the acclaim that it really deserved. And it's Catherine Bigelow, of course, from The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. She told a dramatic retelling of race riots in Motor City, and especially an incident that took place at one particular hotel, a movie called Detroit. And I found this movie to be effective and harrowing and heartbreaking in terms of its depiction of not only broken down race relations, but how a single act of violence can completely alter someone's life trajectory. And it's not, honestly, I think it's a victim to certain criticism from people from Detroit who think that she didn't do a good job telling, quote unquote, their story. There are critics who are really upset about a white person telling a black story. And
right.
And I don't think either of these are, fair. I think it's really effective, the movie.
Wow.
Heartbreaking and harrowing, with some really good, really good performances. And finally, another film that doesn't really deal with race relations per se, but it's a true life drama based on, real events. I think it's about to come out. It's called Crown Heights, and it's from director Matt Ruskin, though it's produced by former all-pro NFL player Nnamdi Asamoah, who also co-stars in the film. And it's about a young man, a West Indies immigrant, who got wrongfully convicted of murder and spent 2 decades in jail, and about his best friend who never gives up on him and who spends all of his life dedicated to getting him out of jail and finally exonerated for this crime. And, we've seen some of these wrongfully convicted movies before. It is estimated that there's 124,000 felons serving in prison right now who were wrongfully convicted in being put in there. So maybe I will say we have too many of these stories when we have 124,001 of these stories. But any story that advocates that we bring a little more conscience and awareness to our system of imprisonment and punishment in this country is certainly a good thing. Is the film flawed? Absolutely. Do I like the film? Yes. And the lead performance by Keith Stanfield, who I had most recently in a terrific supporting role in Get Out. Role is absolutely star-making.
Wow.
Anyway, he plays Colin Warner, the real life man who was wrongfully convicted. Keith Stanfield, this guy is terrific, and I don't think there's any kind of movie he won't be able to do.
Fantastic. I'll be looking out for that.
So that's what I've seen. Anything else you want to wrap up with before we call an end to this? All right.
Well, the one that stood out, of course, I'm not going to talk about cars chasing submarines and Fast Fate and Furious. I'm not talking about it, even though I watched the whole thing from beginning to end. But there was one film. Have you seen this Alone in Berlin with Emma Thompson and who was the actor? Brendan Gleeson?
No.
It's a fantastic film. It's directed by Vincent Perez, who did the Depardieu's Cyrano de Bergerac. And it's set in Berlin during the war. And it's about this couple that loses their son. And they start a protest, a silent, not quite silent protest. They start protesting against Hitler by subversively leaving postcards all over Berlin that say stuff like Hitler will kill your son too, and protest, rise up against Hitler. And then this one police officer who's tracking and collecting all these postcards and trying to figure out who's doing it. And then, of course, the Gestapo overtop the police and how he's being frustrated by that. It's really quite a fascinating, well-acted, heart-rendering tale of the home front of Berlin during World War II. And I stumbled upon this, hadn't heard a thing about it. There it was on the flight, and I was left thinking about it for days afterwards. From what I understand, it was nominated for Golden Bear at the Berlin International Film Festival. But other than that, it hasn't got much traction. So yeah, I was surprised and delighted to find this.
It got dumped into release here in early January of this year to mediocre reviews. And I have not even heard of it. And but, you know, once before you turned me on to a movie starring Emma Thompson, of which I had not heard anything, and that was Last Chance Harvey.
Yes.
And that
remember
was
that?
Quite a winner. If you need no more example of how screwed up the film business is than the fact that Emma Thompson is not starring in movies all the time.
I know. She is a fantastic actress, and here she's obviously picking parts that are literate, that are great scripts. And picking them for the sake of the craft, not about what studio's behind it, what kind of business it's going to do, how this will advance my career, but for one's own personal artistic exploratory range, as it were.
And we don't get to know. And we don't get to know about them. I mean,
and we don't get to know.
Which is stunning because, obviously, and we talk about this a lot before, the business has to change. Yes, It, the new version of the Stephen King novel, has had a huge opening weekend, thus bringing to an end the worst box office spell ever. What do I mean when I say that? I mean the last 2 weeks, the total gross at the box office has been the lowest in 15, 20 years. And 15, 20 years ago, the average ticket price was a lot less, which means the fewest tickets of all time have been sold these last couple weeks leading into it. So, I don't know, take a chance on maybe, doing things a little bit differently. That would be my advice,
maybe.
Hollywood, if you're listening.
There you go.
That brings us to an end of another very lengthy, very globe-trotting, action-packed installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Find all of them at chillpackhollywood.com. Dean, should
follow
people...
Follow us on Twitter.
How should they do that?
Well, by looking at the old handle at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and. And if you do that, stick it in your Instagram, too, because you'll find us there as well.
You just told people to stick it in their Instagram, but before they stick it in their Instagram, like us on Facebook. We're facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Until
like
next week, I'm Phil Larenas. I'm going to stay Phil Larenas.
And I'm Dean Haglund, staying Dean Haglund.
And we'll talk to you then.
I believe in Mom and Dad, and I believe.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.